from an attorney that is working on our staff that it would be possible, probably, to devise laws in Alaska for the 3-mile zone that would meet within the confines of the Alaska Constitution. It would not be an easy task. It would be a very difficult task to devise such legislation, but it is barely possible.
Jim Brooks wants to ask a question of someone.
I recall the Constitution does provide that there shall be no several rights fisheries. However, I know lawyers have thought about this, and we need, in the absence of a change in the Constitution, we need a decision from the court. But when everyone has an equal opportunity to bid on the fish, I think this may be the opening that we're seeking, and it may be entirely possible to do this within the framework of the Constitution as it is right now without any change. The thing is, the problem arises in treating everyone equally. If you grant one person a right to harvest fish, then presumably you are discriminating against others. But if everyone is treated equally and has an equal opportunity to bid, we'll say to harvest the fish in a certain bay for the next 5 years, the people of one community or two or three groups within one community, a marketing association, a union, the cooperative store, they may say, okay, we'll bid on this. This other group will bid on it. And anyone in Alaska has right to bid on it. Then we, I think, avoid the discrimination that the Constitution seeks to restrict. It may be that there's some thought along this in this area by lawyers with the turn of a reasonable type of approach in a limited area. When you start talking about Bristol Bay now, you get many, many forces involved in it. Would be difficult, but in a small way, I think you could consider starting.
Thank you, Jim. Fred Canada, way in the back, please.
You, Paul. Yeah.
I want to address a question that comes to me. It has to do with the problem that his analysis is dealing with. As I understand it, the concern on an expansion path with the trade-off between effort in fishing and stock level. What I'm curious about is the mechanism by which you increase stock, which I think what you said the variable designator R is the idea that you're exploiting biologically separable populations as you go along. Is that the way?
Yeah, that's correct.
The implication of that, then, to use that as a basis for criticizing the efficiency of the Alaska industry, is that, in fact, some fisheries are being intensively fished.
Would you repeat that last statement? I didn't quite hear it.
Long day.
Sought out these initial populations, but it's not the same. Sail up to King Charlotte and question then is, are the facts that you suggest they are, that is, are there large unexploited populations? And is that the brunt of your analysis? If some populations are less?
Well, that's one of the conclusions, you might say, of the analysis. It is true that there are a large number of so-called latent fishery resources which are relatively unexploited. The reason you get this paradox is because there's no ownership. In other words, fishermen can fish the stocks until the economic rent or the value of the resource is dissipated, and they're just covering their opportunity cost, so that you get excessive entry, and therefore these stocks tend to be intensively exploited to the ignoring, as you say, other stocks which are not as fully exploited. This is how this paradox could come about: the fact that they are free to enter, and they will exploit these stocks to their fullest extent, as long as they're covering their opportunity costs. Now, if their opportunity costs are low, as I pointed out, many of the fishermen's opportunity costs are, then you get this to an even much greater degree, you see. They concentrate on these stocks. And generally speaking, you tend to exploit those stocks which are more highly valued than those which are less valued. Am I answering your question?
Your answer is touching the sort of conventional terms of the analysis of a particular fish population. And it strikes me that the analysis you presented does not apply in that context. For the reason that when you're talking about a particular population, you face environmental constraints. That is, that the level of that population depends on such like factors as food supply. And that's usually expressed in the form of function which says for every particular level of effort there's one sustainable population, and you can map R right into E. And if that's the situation you're addressing, I find it hard to see how you have a choice, a probability of substituting R for E. So it strikes me that the conventional model that your answer has suggested, that choice is not open once you assume sustainable yield.
Dr. Kretschel, I'd like to comment on some of these things if you could.
I'm going to sneak the comment in. This is sort of a sneaky way of doing it. Let me just point out that all good economists have models running out their ears. We've got a couple of them in here. We put one of them in there for the specific purpose, which I think Bill partially missed, of pointing out that it was completely inapplicable to a description of the salmon industry, because as Sal made clear at the outset of his discussion, this is a model run in completely steady state terms. But the salmon industry is one properly described as being in continuous short run disequilibrium. These central tendencies may well exist, but they're so swamped by short term variations that the model has a degree of usefulness that I can't really describe in mixed company, but it's not very useful. The other point that I think is perhaps more serious with respect to the use of models of this sort is that we tend to forget conveniently when we're sketching them on the board for classroom purposes that the model operates in this rather simple fashion, first as a biological model and converted economic variables, only on some very specific assumptions as to one species' exploitation. And the one species is largely independent of other species exploitable by the same fishery, or independent on the production side in the sense that it is not competitive in terms of food space and the like. But very few fisheries that are worth talking about are single species fisheries. The great majority of them are carried on mixed stocks with varying degrees of interdependence. And while it is possible to construct models to describe these very much more complicated situations, the ability to put numbers in the coefficients get correspondingly smaller. I don't mean to foul the idea of describing difficult and complex economics operations of this sort by means of analytical models. This is the way we really learn about the variables that we have to keep in mind and the constraints that are imposed on us by the environment in which the animal lives. But it's one thing to use this as an expository device. It's quite another thing to use it as a basis for an applied management program. And they do have to be taken with a good deal of caution in the latter context.
Because the latest hour, I think we probably ought to only go about one more question. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, I'll take 30 seconds, but I certainly agree with Rush. But one thing to criticize the model because it's not comprehensive enough. Another thing to get wrong.
Yeah,
but you sure got to start from the logically correct model. And what I'll press that chance is that my feeling is you are going to do
same yield identifiable population.
Sure.
Can I make one very brief? This discussion on methodology is very interesting. I had a great deal of confusion with this model also when I read the paper five or six times. I think we have to bear in mind that Professor Comitini is dealing with a dynamic situation. He's not talking about some given population or a given species even at a given moment of time. His contours may change through, for example, cycles or through years or through decades. This was very important to his model.
Let's try one more question in the open session, and then perhaps the other questions can be handled first. The first one, a fellow next to John Borbidge.
Frank Peterson. I read in the papers that Alaska is the third largest fishing industry in the nation. I'd like to know, do you folks up there on the panel know who the other two largest fishing industries in the nation are and how our fishing regulations here in Alaska compare to the other two higher fishing industries?
I believe the reference is to the Kodiak being the third.
Two others being the tuna industry in California and and shrimp industry in the southern states.
Let me just comment generally on your questions, Peterson. The state of Alaska has no monopoly on regulations that I think are faulty in objective and concept. There are lots of states with regulations of their fishing industry that make as much difficulty or more as those you find in Alaska. Moreover, it's not confined to salmon. There are regulations, for example, in the state of California, I think still on the books and were for a long time, that prohibited the reduction of certain species for meal and oil because somehow you shouldn't convert fish into food by running it through a chicken. You have to do it directly, even though reducing it for meal and oil was considerably more profitable than putting it in a tin. The collection of state regulations on the efficiency of fishing operations under the guise of conservation in all of the states that have commercial fisheries adds up to such a mixture of confusing, overlapping, and generally restrictive legislation that the American fishing industry has virtually no chance to compete on equal terms with foreign fleets that are now harvesting on our continental shelves a little bit more than all the American flag fleets put together.
Mr. Chairman, may I comment on Mr. Peterson's question?
I think this is a very good question, and I was rather waiting for this type of question to be brought up. I think basically the two other important industries, the tuna industry and the shrimp industry, they operate basically under similar principles. There's no limited entry. Both are open entry fisheries. One thing which hasn't been really discussed too well in our theoretical discussions of limited entry over the last 10 years, I mean 10 years at least, we have discussed this time and again on different occasions, is the dynamics of expansion of fishing. And if you bring in this factor, it will stretch the period of prosperity of any industry. As long as the industry has room for expansion, it happened in the case of room of expansion either through the actual physical expansion of fishing ground or introduction of new technology or expansion of fish market for the product the industry is producing. This has happened in the Californian industry, tuna industry basically, mainly through the introduction of person, very efficient person method and the expansion of the fishing ground to waters of Central and South America. It has happened to the shrimp industry mainly through their expansion of not only the fishing grounds of the domestic shrimp industry, but expansion to the shrimp grounds off the coast of other countries, very often based in those countries, not in the United States. Now, sooner or later, any fishery has reached the same point, you know, the diminishing profitability and the too much effort to produce the same amount of fish. But if we forget this period of dynamic change, you are missing a great point, because many of the fishing industries of the world just went ahead this way, from one fishery to another, from one ground to another, and then in this process accumulated capital for further diversifying their operations, further expanding their fishing grounds. Now, whether this is a bad thing or a good thing in on a long-term basis is another question, but it has to be considered as a very important factor in considering any question of fishery development. Now, this brings up another question. If everybody does this and expands their fishing ground and diversify their activities, sooner or later they'll run into international competition on the same ground for the same stock, very often using the same fishing method. And then naturally they'll run into a very difficult negotiation for arrangements to solve the problems they have, problems arising from international competition. Now, Mr. Harrington's argument already is that therefore, in order to solve all these problems, we must have some established international principles also for dividing ground or dividing stocks or allocating stocks between different countries. I think eventually it is true, but we are still very far from reaching that kind of arrangement. But all I'm saying is we have to consider this dynamic aspect of fishery industry always in the context of limited entry concept. Also, touching on the general question of limited entry, when you have get to the point of legalizing the concept of limited entry and introducing this concept, applying this concept in actual fisheries, not just minor fisheries, but important fisheries, your problems have not been solved. Your problems start, new problems start, only in a different context, because many countries have adopted this concept and they have had just as many problems as your industry, but in a different context. They have one added a powerful means to control the fishery and they use this means of control for whatever appropriate for conservation purposes or diplomatic negotiations. The only difference between the United States and some of the other countries is that you still haven't got this means in the domestic legal framework as a principle applicable to all fishing, while Japan, Russia, Korea, all these other countries do have this means as a method of control, good or bad.
We hear from Lowell.
Well, Dr. Kasahara has said most of the things I was going to say, and quite a few that I wouldn't have said. But I would like to add one little footnote to Mr. Peterson's inquiry, and that is with regard to one of those fisheries that brings in more dollars than Alaska's fisheries, and that's the Southern California tuna industry. It's a fishery that there is every indication is in deep trouble, or very, very close to deep trouble, due to the same old story of more tuna seiners than there are tuna in the eastern Pacific.
Can I just put some numbers on that just by way of illustration for a second? It's been estimated that the fishing capacity of the tuna fleet, exploiting the southeastern Pacific tuna stocks, is going up at better than 10% a year. But the yellowfin tuna, which is the principal species, is already quoted at national, international quota levels. It is, for all practical purposes, as nearly as we can tell, fully exploited. But we've got at least two new countries and at least 10% per year additional capacity from American companies already aimed at a fishery fully exploited. This makes no sense whatsoever, and yet it is going on.
Dr. Kasahara referred to Bill Harrington. He came all the way from Rhode Island. I didn't let him say a word.
I was going to make one comment, and I think you question, but I'm going to make two. The last statement about the women of the California tuna fleet, although I don't disagree in the long run, that fleet is being expanded not just to catch tuna in the eastern Pacific, also to get the tuna off Africa. And they had a podium line, and there are two or three rather smart guys I know that put some money in. So I think they figure that there's still a bit of life left in the tuna industry, and it's not close to that collapse you imply. Now the other comment is, a short time back, you made a statement that sounded like a broadcast condemnation of conservation measures. Now, I'd like to point out, I'm not sure you meant it that way, but that's just the present conservation measures. I'd like to point out that without those conservation measures, you now would have neither stocks of fish left or prosperous fishing. So with those regulations, you at least have a stock of fish. And probably you better keep those conservation measures until you get rid of this concept of common property on fisheries and can apply something that's more effective.
No one would contest this at all, Bill. I mean, the protection of the stocks is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for a healthy industry. Without it, sure, we wouldn't even have the option that we have now. No argument. As far as the tuna thing is concerned, let me correct one point on this. The mere fact that the tuna industry, let's say that the yellowfin tuna catch, cannot be expanded physically is no reason why it may not be financially attractive for new vessels to get in there. As long as the price of tuna is what it is and it's going up, this will remain an attractive fishery, even if you're dividing it into smaller and smaller segments, as long as the price is very favorable. That's exactly the kind of nonsense that we're deeply concerned about. The fact that the boats are built to fish in different areas, as well as in the Southeast Pacific, simply says that you are preparing to generalize a local situation until it becomes a mess of truly oceanic proportion. And that's just exactly what it did.
It was bad biological conditions, but not bad financial conditions.
Well, I think it's headed for bad financial condition right now.
Sure, we got a new target for 10:30. Tom, a question in the back.
I was of the same mind as some of the others about the Alaska constitutional problem until I heard that there might be some other opinion about limiting access. But when you talk about limiting access to fisheries, don't you also have to consider whether, as a matter of policy, you compensate the excluded fishermen who've made an investment in gear and equipment?
We have an attorney who's been working on this over here, and I think he's prepared to make some statement.
I point out that the two specific proposals with respect to a limited entry salmon fishery that have been put forward, the one that Bill spoke of, that a group of us at the University of Washington prepared for the legislature there, and the British Columbia program, both contemplate starting out by blanket licensing of all eligible fishermen, with eligibility determined in part by your actually having fished the license in the preceding season or two. In effect, you blanket license everyone who is in the fishery to start. There are then several avenues through which, over time, you can peel down the size of the fleet without forcing anybody out. Now, you may want to speed it up by forcing people out and compensating them for that. Where you have a fleet and a labor force already pretty much over age, as one of our friends here suggested, the procedure suggested in the Puget Sound study of simply offering to repurchase and retire licenses and gear at, say, 80% of a cooperatively insured value is one possibility of getting a lot of people out who simply don't want to stay in but are hanging on for inability to get their investment out. The fact that the thing will age out by attrition would mean that over a 5 or 10 year period, which is probably about the shortest you could consider for really getting it cut down, say by 33 1/3 or 50%, a lot of the people will have left the fishery, and if you simply amputate the new sources coming in, you achieve a considerable reduction without putting much, if any, pressure on individuals already there. You might offer them the voluntary opportunity to get out and finance that from a revolving fund. But your point is well taken. No system that imposes really difficult hardships, particularly on people like the native fishermen who have immobility problems, would be either equitable or probably legal.
May I agree and add just a note that any situation deserves a specific study aimed at its particular problems, that it's going to be extremely difficult to generalize. And hence, we ought to look at small stocks and small groups of people, fishermen and processors, who may be concerned and solve the problems that they raise.
Before we adjourn, let me just get one final comment from Bob Palmer.
It has to be a question again, though. Are you saying that when you blanket register these fishermen, yet you're implying that there's no provision for new entry into the fishery? And that this is not discriminatory, that this is constitutionally legal?
Yeah, there have been a number of tests of this from the standpoint of the federal constitution and some other state constitution in this sense. Once the property right is established, anyone has the same opportunity for access to the industry that he has, say, in farming. It's not recommended legally that you go out and start chopping somebody's apples down unless you have purchased the orchard or leased it. And in effect, you're in a position of saying that anyone can get into the fishery who wants to purchase a right to participate or lease it, undertake any other arrangement. The difficult transition is to get that property right established without respect to
it. Purchasing.
That's right. I think those licenses have got to be made transferable within at least a very short period of time, quite apart from the legal aspect, to ensure that you get what we'd like very much to see, a tendency for the licenses to gravitate toward the more efficient, the more professionalized fishermen, and therefore to promote the greatest efficiency as you develop the fish.
And what is especially important in many fishing families, that a right be inheritable.
But where does this reduce gear if it is transferable, if the gear license is attractive enough now, economically speaking, and we're hoping for an increase in the resource, will it not then be more economically attractive? Then why will we have any attrition? Why will not all of these overage fishermen find a ready sale of their beach sites, of their boat gear license, whatever it may be, to a new fisherman who wants to get into it. Why would there be any attrition?
Well, two things. One is that you would normally, in the course of a gear reduction program of this sort, accompany it with a stiffer and stiffer tax, license fee, whatever you want to call it, for the right to participate. As in effect, what you're doing is substituting a state tax receipt for what is now wasted in excess gear. You know, black magic. But this would have to be a necessary part.
Now, would you give the years on this license fee? $300?
Well, it would depend on how fast you want to move.
License fees for Japanese tuna vessels have gone for as high as $500,000, isn't it?
Oh, no, not that high.
That was in the brother. I would defer to adjourn now and have whoever else the question come forward and speak to the person.
Can I just make a correction about something earlier? Copper fees were in the Union Building, not in the
Thanks, thanks everybody for coming.
Let's have a drinking session. That's what we need. It's a long day.
Go ahead.
Hello, John.
How are you?
How are you?
I come up to the fight.
John?
Damn right. I'm here. I'm going to get called up to the economist. I
have three economists. Well, if you're going to fight with economists,
that's why I never fight with a
biologist.
We were willing to fight because we don't have hard empirical knowledge.
Right here.
The other side is
that's your point.
I won't try to defend it, but this is no excuse for letting it go.
We have many social persons right now coming into play. So maybe the 3.5 million better for him to raise his kids down there.
I'm not prepared to argue. In fact, I'd extend one step and say that all I'm saying is the evidence is overwhelming. This is a
Thank you.